Okay, Boker Tov, everybody, or Tzoraim Tov, wherever you might be. Welcome. Just a quick reminder, I'll send that by email. Next week, it'll be a slightly different login. We'll do our summer login. Because we're having a whole bunch of new series, you don't have to re-register for this class. And I'm sorry if I didn't make it clear on the email I sent out last night. But for now, for the ongoing classes, we're continuing the old login. It's the same login, just instead of spring as the password, we'll have it as a summer. But I'll send you the link by email before. Anybody who registered the prior registers now, you'll automatically get on the list and then we'll send. So that's just a bit of bookkeeping stuff. Okay, let's get started. So last week we finished off, we're in Perek Dalet. In my Mishnayot, as we've discussed, often the Mishnah numbering in the Siddur and various editions in Perkei Avot is different than in the Mishnah. But it's we finish Mishnah Vav, Rav Yossi Omer Kol HaMachabed at HaTorah. We're talking about honor of the Torah. You have to dress properly and speak properly and honor scholars more than you honor the Torah itself. And you have to examine every letter in the Torah, meaning showing its value, etc. That was the end of last class. I just want to spend a couple minutes on who Rav Yossi was. He was the author of that Mishnah. I always think it's good, especially since Perkei Avot is really the summary of our tradition, Moshe Kibbel Torah Misinai. And then, as we discussed last year, it lists off who were the rabbis, who were the sort of the leading rabbis in every generation, the Chachmei HaMasorah, as we often call it, the wise men of our tradition. And that's really what Perkei Avot is, our transmission of the oral law from one generation to another, from the pre-Rabbinic Judaism, Moshe, but really from the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, beginning of the Second Temple period, till after the destruction and the exile, Rav Yehuda HaNasi and his son is actually quoted, so we're talking in the 3rd century. Anyway, so Rav Yossi is one of the students of Rabbi Akiva. We know that Rabbi Akiva had 20, I imagine it's not, it's an exaggeration. I don't believe it's necessarily literal, but who knows? Rabbi Akiva had 24,000 students. 12,000 pairs of students, as we all know. The Talmud, in a cryptic statement, says they all died between Pesach and Shavuot. No mourning customs were instituted for that. The Gemara there, the discussion, I don't know if I mentioned that recently, the Gemara is really the discussion about having children. That's where that discussion takes place. It's in Yevamot on the Mishnah that it's a debate how many children does one is supposed to have to fulfill the mitzvah of Peruvu. We know there's a debate between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. Beit Shammai says two males, and Beit Hillel says a male and a female. It's in that Mishnah that the Talmud has a discussion. It says you should have children when you're young, and you should have children when you're older. You never know what's going to be. It's always good to have. You should always do things. Don't just say I'm finished. Move on, should have when you're young and when you're old. And then the Gemara says, and you should have students. And remember, we always compare our students to our children. Bishinantun lefanecha, teach your children. These are our students. So the Talmud says you should have students when you're young and continue teaching when you're old. That's the greatest thing for an older person. They can continue, teaching if their mind is sharp. And then it says the story. You know why? Because Rabbi Akiva, you see, he had 24,000 students when he was younger. He couldn't have been so young because he was ignorant till the age of 40. But it means in his early career. In his early career, he had 24,000 students. And, they all died. If he would have stopped then, we wouldn't be here today. The only reason we're here today is because he later on, when he was an old man already, after the 24,000 students had died, he had 5 new students. That's so Rabbi Yossi. Those are Rabbi Meir, the famous Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rav Elazar ben Shamua, who is probably the least famous. Now, 4 of the 5, Rav Meir, Rav Yehuda, anybody who learns Mishnayot or learns Gemara, they're quoted like in every Mishnah. And these are actually the 4 most quoted people in the entire Mishnah. Rav Meir, Rav Shimon, Rav Yehuda, and Rav Yossi. So this is the generation really after the Hadrianic, persecutions. These are the 5 students who spread Torah. The Sanhedrin is in Usha. It's moved from Yavne, moved from Yerushalayim to Yavne, of course. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai moved the head of the Supreme Court, whatever you want to call it, to the city of Yavne on the coast, and then they had to move up north. They moved to Usha, and that's this generation. And then Rabbi Yossi got smicha from Yehuda ben Bava. That the Gemara has a whole story of Yehuda ben Bava. We'll read about him, unfortunately, on Tisha B'Av. He gave smicha, the real ordination that we mentioned before. Rabbis today, we don't have real rabbis. There's no such thing as a rabbi. What I mean, there's no such thing as a rabbi. It means a rabbi's a teaching degree. We discussed he has to know how to speak well, etc. But there's no power. There's nothing a rabbi can do that somebody else can't do. Nothing. If the wedding, whatever, whoever knows what they're doing can do. When you have real smicha, that was handed down from generation to generation from Moshe Rabbeinu, so then that person can be a member of a Sanhedrin. And as was discussed, I think, in Ari Schwartz's class this past Monday, and Rav Kook, when he was discussing Rav Kook, saying that in the Third Temple, there's a possibility we will not have animal sacrifices. What do we want of animal sacrifices? Half the Torah is about animal sacrifices. No. The Sanhedrin will decide that we don't need it anymore, because the Sanhedrin has a tremendous amount of power. A tremendous amount of power to really, now's not the time to get into it, but even to, let's say, reinterpret and sometimes even possibly overturn the Torah. Matter of fact, the fact that we wrote down the oral law was an overturning of the Torah. The Torah is not allowed. It's a biblical prohibition to write down the oral law. But Rabbi Yehuda Nasi quoted a verse, Eit lasot l'shem hefer Torah techa. There's a time to act for God. We have to nullify our Torah, because if we didn't write down the oral law, we wouldn't be here. That would have been the end of Judaism. So the Sanhedrin has a tremendous amount of power, as many people know, but we don't have a Sanhedrin. So, and you need to have smicha to have a Sanhedrin. So it's very important. The Romans learned their lesson. The Romans gave in to Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, gave in. The Romans, oh, go to Yavne, who cares? You know, we took over here the temple, Yerushalayim. The Jews want to have a little shtetl in Yavne. That's okay with us. And they didn't realize Yavne saved, you know, Judaism. And then they wised up. I mean, they realized the importance of smicha. So they forbade smicha at the penalty of death. And we'll read on the keynote on Tisha B'Av, Rav Yehuda ben Bava was the last one to give smicha. Rav Yossi, this whole chevra got smicha, and they found him, and they put 300 spears in his body, and they killed him, and whatever, very, very sad. He was one of the Asara Haruge Malchut, one of the 10 martyrs. So this is the generation between Yavne and the writing of the Mishnah. All these generations are important. These are the founding fathers, you know, so to speak, of rabbinic Judaism. We've mentioned, I'm sure many people know, there's also, I think, Rabbi Schwartz also was talking very briefly about it. There were two major attempts in Jewish history to recreate a Sanhedrin. In other words, to redo smicha. It's based on a Rambam. The Rambam, I think I mentioned, I brought up the book before, I don't know when it's come up, Rav Yehuda Leib Maimon, the first minister of religion in the state of Israel, was a learned person, a very learned Jew, wrote a 100-page book, Why We Should Reinstitute, How We Can Reinstitute a Sanhedrin Today. It's based on the Rambam, who says, Yirah Eli, it appears to me, the Rambam, in other words, he doesn't have a real source. Every once in a while, the Rambam writes that expression, it appears to me. Meaning, the Rambam never quotes his sources, but the assumption that's a lot of the work on the Rambam is figuring out his source, because he will often in one paragraph, he'll have 8 different sources. I mean, the brilliance of the Rambam, he just puts them, weaves them in so beautifully, but he doesn't tell you what the sources are. But so the commentaries will tell you what the source. Sometimes they're not sure what the source is. Sometimes they themselves, we don't know. Maybe he has some text somewhere, maybe Rishami, maybe. But when the Rambam, quote unquote, makes it up, when he doesn't really have a source, it's just based on what he thinks. So he'll write the term Yirah Eli. It appears to me. I don't have a source. It appears to me that if all the rabbis in the world would agree, we can reinstitute smicha. Of course, all the rabbis in the world agree on anything, the Mashiach will be here. But anyways, and that was the big fight. We're not going to get into all details. In the 16th century, there's always messianic fervor and, you know, after terrible, terrible tragedies, that's when people look forward to a better future, obviously. So after the Spanish Inquisition and the expulsion, Rabbi Yosef Caro was expelled from Spain. He was born in 1488. He makes his way to Tzfat, and many of the people in Tzfat were expelled from Spain, and the exile. So they saw, the redemption is coming. That's the suffering before the redemption. Now we're going to have to make a Sanhedrin. And Rav Yosef Karo was one of the people who got smicha, which is one of the reasons he wrote a Shulchan Aruch. He wrote the Code of Jewish Law because this was going to be the constitution of the new Jewish state. No, it didn't quite work out that way. And there was big fights. And Rav Yaakov Bei Rava, he was one of gay smicha, big fights about it. And then there was an attempt, of course, in the 20th century, as we mentioned, to reduce smicha. And there are nowadays, I don't know, little attempt, but it'll be a long time. Anyways, that's just a little bit of background. Rav Yosef Bar Chalafta, the Gemara says, you know, tzedek tzedek tirdof, you have to pursue justice. So the Gemara gives up a list. How do you pursue justice? So it says you go to Rabbi Akiva in Bnei Brak, and you go to Rabban Gamliel in Yavne, and go to Rav Yosi in Sipori. And you go to Rav Yosi. In other words, the Gemara is listing off all the rabbis who ran the courts, who were the people who gave forth great justice. And that Rav Yosi in Sipori. It's interesting. Sipori's up north. Small little town now, I think there are like 1,000 people who live there in the ancient town of Sipori. And the Romans actually exiled him. The famous the story when Rav Shimon Bar Yochai in the cave, that story begins with Rav Yehuda, a contemporary. They're all students. These are all students of Rabbi Akiva, Rav Shimon Bar Yochai too. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai and Rav Yehuda and Rav Yosi are sitting around and talking. And Rav Yehuda says, those Romans, they're really great. You know, maybe they destroyed our temple, but I mean, he didn't say those words, but it's clear. I mean, this is, you know, a couple of generations later. And, you know, they build roads and marketplace and the economy. Rome is an advanced society and there's a lot we can learn from the Romans. And we should be very thankful for the Romans. What they weren't bothering us now and everything's good. And Rav Yossi's sitting there and he doesn't say anything. Does he agree? Does he not agree? Don't know. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, are you crazy? The Romans, they're the worst of the worst. They build bridges that they can bring over all the prostitutes, and they do this to collect the taxes. So they wanted to kill Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. And Rav Yehuda, they wanted to make him, give him a reward. Wow, he spoke so nicely on the Romans. And Rav Yosi, who remained silent, who didn't go out and vote. Like they had a vote yesterday in Syria, you know, 95.1%. That's, I don't know what democracy in the world, somebody gets 95% of the vote. But anyways, you know, they make you vote. So Rav Yosi didn't vote. He remained silent. So the Romans exiled him. And then he ended up in Sipori. They exiled to Sipori. So that's the sort of ironic. I think the rabbis are picking up on this irony. They exiled Sipori. So Rav Yosi ends up building up a great yeshiva in Sipori. That's where we can fill the verse of Tzedek Tzedek Tirdof. Okay, let's move on to the next mission, unless there's any questions about Rav Yosi. Okay, Mishnah Zayin. Rav Yishmael Beno, the Rav Yishmael, the son of Rav Yosi, says, this is a powerful Mishnah. Hachoshech atzmo min hadin, one who darkens himself, hachoshech, it's choshech, hachoshech atzmo min hadin, somebody who darkens himself from judgment, horeik, he throws off, he gets rid of, mimenu eva, hatred, gezel, thievery, shvuat shav, false oaths, somebody who's arrogant, his heart is full of, he's telling people what to do all the time. He answers all the questions. Yes, this is allowed, this is not. Shote, he's an idiot. A shote, a cheresh and a shote is a, the Gemara defines a shote, the indication of a shote, one who rips his clothes, whatever, he's crazy. So it doesn't, often in halacha, when a shote is exempt from mitzvot, it means he's, well, we would call today mentally ill. A shota is really somebody who has mental health issues that are serious enough that he can't function normally in society. So in the time of the Mishnah, the way the Gemara defines a shota, somebody who walked alone at night, obviously in the ancient world, pre-electricity, you didn't go out at night and they closed the gates in the city. So somebody who's wandering the streets at night, he's got an issue. And or he rips his clothes, etc. So, but it really means anybody who is mentally ill, unfortunately. So that person is exempt from mitzvot. We can't expect a person to that person to go to shul to hear shofar, to eat matzah. He's not capable. What can you do? But here, of course, a shota doesn't mean it in that sense. It means he's stupid. He's an idiot. Well, what is he getting involved? What do you want to tell people what to do? The Gus Ruach, and he's a Shota, and he's a Rasha. He's evil. We'll get there. What's worse, being an idiot or being evil? It's which one is worse? Begas ruach, and he's very haughty. So this Mishnah is very strange. Why is this Mishnah very strange? The Mishnah is clearly has a very negative view on people who sit in judgment, who, you know, you want to come get appointed to Supreme Court of Canada or one of the lower courts or whatever. That's what it says. He doesn't want to judge. Don't ask another rabbi. I don't want to take the responsibility for that. So what do you mean? Well, that's being a dayan is the greatest thing in the world. That's it's probably even more important than learning Torah itself. It's what we were and this is, I think, really the continuation. Remember, we were learning the last week, really 2 weeks ago, that the purpose of learning is a teaching. That's a basic purpose of learning. But the primary purpose of learning beyond teaching is to observe the Torah. It's very nice. We said Talmud Torah is, that's in theory, that is like theoretical physics, but then you need applied physics. Everything, if it stays in the laboratory, it isn't worth very much. If the Torah stays in the Beit Midrash and doesn't go out into the world, of what use is Torah? That's why we mentioned the Mishnah doesn't even mention a person who learns for the sake of learning, just so he should know. That's like almost nothing. I mean, I don't say it's totally nothing, but people have intellectual thing, but the idea of learning, for you should learn, and we discussed that all the mitzvot in the Torah of teaching Torah, of learning Torah, are in the context of how to teach. To teach your children, It's not about how to learn. So this Mishnah, being a dayan, is the continuation. That's putting Torah into real world practice. Two people on Wall Street, there are some corporate issue. So they decide to go to a Beit Din, and the Beit Din says, who owes who money, and how you split the deal, and who's right. That's extremely important. That's the ultimate in Torah. It's so much important in Torah that the Gemara says, "Kol hadan emet dan din emet lamito." A person who judges a true judge becomes a true judgment. Naseh, it becomes a shutaf lahakadosh baruch hu b'maseh bereshit. He becomes a partner to go with God in the creation of the world. In other words, the ultimate purpose of creation is fulfilled when a person renders a judgment. So that should be, in a sense, the goal of learning, because you're learning, you're teaching, and you're applying, not only for yourself, but you're applying for the people who come to you. So what in the world, why is Rabbi Shmuel saying something so negative? You should sort of be, want to have nothing to do with judgment, and you know, you'll have a much more pleasant life. You won't have hatred and thievery and shuat shav. Okay, so on the one level, they're both true. You know what? Important jobs in life often come at a great cost. So you're being a judge, it's really important. But the bottom line is you're going to have Eva and Gazel and Shuat Shav. You have to do it. Why? You're going to issue a judgment. The litigant's not going to like you. You ruled against him. Remember, in pre-democratic age, I think today, you know, we live in a society, thank God, where, you know, yes, we have lots of complaints about things, but the bedrock of democracy is our judicial system. I mean, and the founders of America, the brilliant founders of America, and the checks and balances, and I think they proved themselves. The recent president tried to undo the checks and balances, and Baruch Hashem, they held. The democracy didn't fall apart, unlike in Belarus or other countries where there is no democracy, or Turkey and whatever, and that's whatever. So our democracies or our judicial systems in strong democratic countries are really, really powerful. They really, really work well. But I think in the ancient world, there was much more bribery. I mean, it's still, you know, and things, I think the rabbis were quite concerned about these issues. So I think it's more so then than perhaps it is now. And we know, unfortunately, I mean, it's unfortunately not every Beit Din is, you know, the most whatever. They don't have the highest professional standards, all of them. That's an unfortunate reality. And whatever, Beit Din is very important. And Ve'elam mishpatim asher tasim lifneim, you're not, so two Jews should never be in a secular court. I mean, not never. Obviously, there are certain things that Beit Din can't handle because we don't have a Sanhedrin, but 98% of the time, two Jews who have a monetary dispute should never be in a secular court. But we know it doesn't work that way. And sometimes the Beit Din will tell you to go to secular court because they can't enforce a judgment because they don't have the power to enforce. So it is a little bit of an issue, you know, the professionalization and whatever. Part of it is they don't have the mandate, but part of it is the professionalism. And I'd say, whatever, I'm not here to advertise or anything, but the RCA Beit Din has made great efforts in being very high professional standards and et cetera. But anyway, they could be both true, that one who sits as a judge is a partner with God. It's Torah in practice. It's the highest level, but people aren't going to like you. And there'll be Ava, there'll be enmity towards you. Gazelle, there'll be thievery. Sometimes people lie. You make a mistake. We'll get there. The judge can make a mistake. And the judge makes a mistake and somebody's owed a lot of money by mistake, pays money. So in a certain sense, the judge is guilty. He can cause a false oath. People might lie under oath, or the judge may improperly impose an oath. So it could be, on the one hand, that they're both true. He's saying the reality is, if you want to avoid getting your hands dirty, don't become a judge. But you know what? You have to get your hands dirty. The great rabbis get their hands dirty. So that's one interpretation. But I don't know if that's the main one. I think what he's talking about here is, I want to talk about the very important concept. I'm sure it comes up a lot, you know, between din, judgment, and lifnin mishur ha-din. Lifnim Mishur Adin, right? Let me throw out there. If you want to put it on the chat box or unmute yourself, how would you translate Lifnim Mishur Adin?
Beyond the letter of the law.
Beyond
the letter of the law?
Yeah, beyond the letter of the law. So I think I mentioned this one. Yeah, that's how most people translate it, beyond the letter of the law or the spirit of the law. Okay, that's very nice. But what do the words mean? Lifnim Mishur Adin. It's not incorrect, and everybody says that expression, and that's what I expect people to say. But if you look at the words, it's Lifnim before, Lifnei Shurat Adin, the straightness of the law. We'll get there in a moment. That's what, before the straightness of the law, in front of the line of law. Yeah, right. A Shura is a line. Okay, we'll come back to that. Now, I began the introduction to the Mishnah by pointing out that the problem with the Mishnah is the Talmud says, Kol hadan din emet la'amito. I didn't really translate emet la'amito. One who judges a judgment, emet la'amito, truth to truth, that's the person who becomes partners with God, that in the creation of the world. So all the, what do you mean truth to truth? You know, we know the difference between truth, emet, and sheker is truth is the same. It's always true. And Sheker, right? Everybody knows, you know, Emet, you know, they taught you in grade three, right? Emet is Aleph, Mem, and Taf have a flat bottom, you know, when you do it in block letters. And Sheen, Kuf, and Resh just have one leg. So it's wobbly. Sheker is wobbly. And Emet is foundational, you know. And then Aleph is the first letter, Mem is the middle letter, right? You know all this, I hope, or maybe not. Taf is the last letter, because truth is the same beginning, the end. Sheker, Shin, Kuf, Resh, or Kuf, Resh, Shin are three letters next to each other, because a lawyer, as we all know, has to have a phenomenal memory. And because a lawyer, it's only true, it's only works here, then this one, that one, he's always has to cover for himself. So Sheker has to be next to each other, and Emet is all over. So Emet is always true. So how can you have Emet, truth to truth? It's either true or it isn't true. What do you mean Emet Lamito? So the probably the most famous comment, and it gets quoted a lot, is by the Drisha. The Drisha is a commentary on the Tur. The Tur, of course, was the son of the Rosh. I mean, I don't know how much we should go into this. I always enjoy doing this, as you know, people should know who the you know, our people in history are, our great writers. The Rosh is the student of the Maharam of Rutenberg. And when the Maharam of Rutenberg gets arrested in Germany, the Rosh flees, you know, Germany, Rabbeinu Asher, and he comes to Spain, and he, Toledo, and he's appointed the rabbi in Toledo in 1303. The Rashba, Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, the top student of the Ramban, Nachmanides, is in where's the Rashban now? In Barcelona, near Barcelona. Now I forget exactly where he is, but he's around Barcelona. And he hears the Rush, the great, great leader of Ashkenaz.
Gerona,
correct, where Rabbeinu Yonah was. Thank you very much. Thank you, correct, in Gerona. Yes, I believe. And then he comes to Spain, and the Rashba writes a letter to the rabbis in Toledo, which is about an hour outside of Madrid. Madrid didn't exist back then, I don't think. And they appoint him the rabbi, and the Rush is like, well, what's going on here? All these strange customs, you know, he's an Ashkenazi and he comes into Spain. It's not like today. They didn't have communication. They didn't know what was going on before. So it's a very shocking to him. Lots of interesting things he wanted to change. He couldn't change. We shouldn't change, whatever. His son is the tour. The tour is already half Sephardi. Now, why do I say that? Because codes of Jewish law were only written by Sephardim. Ashkenazim never wrote codes. And the methodology of learning Ashkenazim, a friend of mine, my chavrusa, who I learned Yoredei with when he did his master's, he went to Yale as an undergraduate. He now teaches in Ramaz, acting, I think he may have been the head of school. So he did his undergraduate degree at Yale. And then he wrote it on his master's thesis, or he wrote a thesis on the difference between Ashkenazic and Sephardic approaches to halakha. And the Ashkenazic Balei HaTosafot, Rashi Tosafot, they didn't write codes, they wrote commentaries. They asked questions, they proposed three answers. They were very much opposed to codification. There's always been this big debate in Jewish history. There's been many rabbis who oppose codification because it would tie the hands of the rabbis. It wouldn't give them the freedom. I don't agree with what Joseph Caro wrote. I am going to rule on my own. There's always been debates. Today, we don't even realize that because the codes have become so accepted. So Ashkenazim never wrote codes. They wrote commentaries. All the codes, the Rif, the Rambam, the Tur, and the Shulchan Aruch. The Tur is born in Ashkenaz, but he grows up. He's really a Sephardi. And so all the four major codes in Jewish history were all written by the Sephardim. So the Tur writes his code in the 14th century. And that serves as the backdrop to the Shulchan Aruch. And then the Ramah wrote... on the tour, you have a series of the most important commentary on tour, of course, is the Beit Yosef, Rav Yosef Caro. Rav Yosef Caro wrote a Beit, it'll take you 20 years to read the whole Beit Yosef. It's like enormous. Everything that was ever written about any topic is in the Beit Yosef. And that's why he realized it's too much. No one's going to read this. I mean, not no one, but very few people are capable or have the time, even if they are capable, to read this. So he shortened it. He made 1% of the Beit Yosef, a Shulchan Aruch. Bottom line is what you do. Here's the set table. But and then basically many of the commentaries from the tour transferred over to the Shulchan Aruch. So you have the Darchei Moshe on the tour. Darchei Moshe is from Moshe Isserles, the Ramah. So he writes the Darchei Moshe on the tour, and then he writes the Ramah on the Shulchan Aruch. And then you have the Sma. You have all these commentaries who wrote both on the tour and on the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is really an update of the tour. Anyways, that's just interesting or not interesting background. One of the commentaries is of the Drisha and the Prisha. That's he wrote two commentaries, like a lot of people. They wrote side by side, one expands on the other. One is the basic, and then he sometimes like a footnote, one sort of a footnote on the other. So that's Rav Yoshua Falk, who wrote this 16th century Poland, if I'm not mistaken. So he has an unbelievable comment, but a very powerful comment that's discussed a lot. He says that what Emet Lamito means is that a Dayan it's not enough if what the Dayan says is true. Something true can be totally false. And if it's not applied, probably it's got to be as he writes, the words he writes, lefi hamakom u lefi hazman. It's got to be according to the place and the time. Halakha is not a computer. And you can't put in data and, and just get it's spit out. We've spoken about this. It's an important concept. The halakha is very much dependent on situation, which is one of the reasons people were opposed to codification, because codification sort of, it's always the same. And rabbis thought, no, we have concepts. We'll write commentaries. You have all these different concepts floating around, and then each rabbi has to apply. Now, that's much harder, of course. Codes make it much easier to apply law, which is the reason they're done. And some of the complaint was that for an average person, we for sure need codes. But even for the great rabbis, one of the complaints was the rabbis are lazy. These great rabbis, and instead of going to the Gemara and working out themselves, they're just going to look it up in the Shulchan Aruch. Today, we think that's great. Wow, the rabbi can look it up in the Shulchan Aruch and the Mishnah Berurah. And the Aruch, you know, wow, that's amazing. But that was considered a critique. What's the rabbi relying on these opinions for? So anyway, so he writes that emet la'amito means that it's true in theory, but it's true lefi ha'makom ulefi hazman. It's got to be applicable to something, and that's why we mentioned, that's why a person on issues that relate to, you know, where you live. So that's why an Israeli rabbi shouldn't issue a ruling for life in America. It doesn't understand life in America, and an American shouldn't issue rulings for Israel. On the kashrut of swordfish, that I don't think it depends where you live. But we're talking about an issue, college, and all kinds of issues that deal with the business world and black or non-Jews, a million issues that are different in Israel. The shul, woman rabbis, it's very different in Israel than in America. The situation's a very different situation. So the response is going to be very, very different, as it should be, and it must be. We unfortunately live in a generation where everything on the internet in 5 seconds and the store and everything could be the same. The halakha was never like that. The halakha was always so dina met lamito means, so you could have where two people are arguing. And if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, so Reuven is right, but you know, yeah, but you don't understand that way. We didn't have any corporations in the time of the Talmud. So the Talmud didn't talk about corporations. So the Talmud didn't have a concept of bankruptcy, but we live with Dina Demachut. So it's true. If you apply the Talmudic law, you get one thing, but you know, we're not living in Talmudic law anymore. So this is hard. To know how to do this is very hard. But that's the role. That's why to be a dayan is very important now, and that's what we're going to discuss in a second. That's why we avoid dayanut, because we don't want that responsibility. Not only do you have to know the halakha inside out, you have to know how to apply the halakha lefi hamakom ulefi hazman. The Beit Yosef, he's commenting. The Beit Yosef writes that, this is in the first page in Choshen Mishpat. If you open up your Choshen Mishpat in the tour, the section of the tour in the Shulchan Aruch that deals with our business law, so it's right there on the first page. I think it's on the second side of the first page, whatever. You have this comment of the Drisha, that it's got to be lefi hamakom ulefi hazman. And you have the comment of the Beit Yosef, then who becomes the author of the Shulchan Aruch, that the purpose of din, and we had this in the first parak in Perkei Avot, al shlosha dvarim ha'olam kayam, al adin ha'emet v'hashalom, on judgment, truth, and peace. So he says the din must lead to emet and shalom. And now we know emet and shalom are contradictions often.
Yes.
Always, of course. You can't have peace in a sense without truth. There's a little bit of that comes up now a lot, right? People have to acknowledge what the truth is, but if you are totally insistent on the truth, you'll never have peace. You have to have compromise. Ha'amet v'ashalom ehavo. That's the pasuk in Zechariah, right? Som ha-rivi'i, v'tsom ha-chamishi, v'tsom ha-shvi, v'tsom ha-siri, yele sasona l'simcha. That's the pasuk we say, we relate to on the fast days, that the fast of the fourth month, like Tammuz, the fifth month of the seventh month, Tzom Gedalia, not Yom Kippur, that's the biblical fast, but these rabbinic fasts, and Tzom Asiri, the 10th month in Tevet, these days, which are the four fast days of mourning, Yule Sasona Lusimcha, will be one day, days of judgment. That's what some people thought with the creation of Israel. Maybe we shouldn't fast anymore. Okay, whatever. Ha'amet v'hashalom ha'avo. You should love peace and truth. That's the, I believe, continuation pasuk. And Rav Soloveitchik, I think, quoting his father, point out that's what does one have to do with the other? So he says, because only in the future, only when we won't have the fast days, only when we'll have the redemption, will truth and peace be able to coexist. We live in a world where there's always a tension between truth and peace. And the judge, it's more important, the judge, the deen has to be a deen emet and shalom. He's got to balance. And you can't look in any code, and you can't just apply what it says in Shulchan Aruch. You begin there, and then you shift it, lefi hamakom u'lefi hazman. So that's probably the reason that Rabbi Yossi is saying, you know, Rabbi Shmuel, don't be a judge. Don't be, this is just, it's too impossible to do this task. So what do you do? It is very important to become a partner. So that's where you get to Lifnei Meshurat Hadin. So that's where you get to before the strangeness of the law or however you want to call it. And that's what the Gemara calls, it's actually not what the Gemara calls, it's for salivation, equated the two. We discussed before, whenever two litigants come before court, the judges are supposed to say, do you want to do deen or pshara? Deen is law, the strictness of the law. We're going to apply the law, win or lose, you know, all or nothing. In most cases, the law is all or nothing. And most cases, in other words, if you're 51% right, you get 100% of the money, kind of like the U.S. Electoral College. You know, you win in the state by one vote, you get all the electoral votes. Or in Canada, you know, first past the post, you get more than the whatever, you know, your party gets only 37% of the vote, but the other got 32 and 29. You win, you get 100% of the seats. You get a majority government with here at 38% or so, whatever. So that's usually how deen works. Deen is, even though it's not really all or nothing, but you won, you barely won, but you barely win is good enough, right? If the Leafs lose in overtime in game 7, they can't say they almost won. That's okay. Those who know what I'm talking about. Okay, if you don't, you're lucky. Okay, but if you're a long-suffering Toronto Maple Leaf hockey fan, Game 6 is on Saturday night. Fine, but stay there. Anyways, so I lost my train of thought. So if you win by a little, you win everything. Pshara means maim koshrim. It's neither hot nor cold. Lukewarm, you know, it's parv. You're right, but you know, they're mitigating circumstances. It's this, you don't understand. This, all kinds of factors that are beyond his control, even though the halakha strictly doesn't care about that. But in fairness, we should care. So that's what we call a pshara. Rav Soloveitchik said that pshara is basically deen of Lifnei Meshurat Hadin. It's a judgment of Lifnei Meshurat Hadin. Now, I said, what does Lifnei Meshurat Hadin mean? So Lifnei Meshurat Hadin means before Lifnei, before the straightness, the line, ashura of the judgment. It means, ideally, the case should never come to deen. We want to act on the case before it gets this. See, the law is straight. The law is straight. Doesn't know any tricks. Doesn't know zman. Doesn't know makom. It doesn't know anything. In straight, as the Talmud says, yikov hadin et hahar. The law pierces a mountain. The law couldn't care less. The person's an orphan, a widow, is poor. It doesn't matter. Racialized, were discriminated against their whole life, were sexually abused. Doesn't matter. The law is the law. You were sexually abused. Too bad. And what does that have to do with the monetary case? So we know that's not nice to say. But the law can't say, well, because you were abused, therefore in business, you did something wrong. We're going to give you the free content. That's ridiculous. But in pshara, maybe that's very important. I'm not saying yes or no. I'm just saying these are issues you have to think about. Lufi ha-makom or lufi ha-zman. Deen, it pierces the mountain. It knocks everything out. It doesn't care about anything. Lifnin, Meshurat Hadin. So we want you to act in a way that we don't have to do that.
All right.
One of the way we do that is through either by you settle before you get to court, people just, you know, have seichel, or you do pshara, you do a compromise, and you tell, now the litigants have to agree. You can't force a litigant. A litigant has the right to demand deen. And as a matter of fact, the Eretz Yisrael says this Mishnah, one of his interpretations of Mishnah, totally flips the Mishnah on its head. He says it's not talking about the judges, it's talking on the litigants. HaChoshech HaTzmo Min HaDin means litigants should never go to court. They should always settle, go to an arbitration panel, go to your friends who you trust. We have that concept. Ne'aman Alai Abba, the Mishnah in Sanhedrin says two people are having a fight. So you know what? Let's go to your father or to our friend. He's a really sharp guy. He's not learned. He doesn't know anything. He doesn't know the Shulchan Aruch. He never heard of the Shulchan Aruch. But he's an honest, fair, he's a sharp guy, he's in business, and he's in integrity. Let's go to him, and we'll accept whatever he says. The mission says 100% acceptable. Not only acceptable, it's laudable. And that's a wonderful thing. In other words, the judge doesn't have to know the Shulchan Aruch. If you're doing a judgment based on Dinei Torah, so he's got to know the Torah and the Shach and the Taz and the Pizkei Tshuva, and he's got to know, and then the Ksarachoshen and the Nesivas, go crazy. He's got to learn for 25 years. till he knows this stuff. But if it's you're not doing strict justice, like strict law, so the guy can be a total ignoramus. And that's so neman alai apa. He can even be a relative. That's what we're saying. Neman, even your father. I trust your father, and I'm willing to do whatever he says, even though normally, and that's the powerfulness of the example. We know, of course, that a relative is not allowed because there's subconscious biases. Right, everybody is biased, right? It's impossible. That's to be a human being. So that's why the Torah is so strong against any form of bribery. Even a good morning to a judge is not allowed. If one litigant is not allowed to say good morning to a judge, the judge has to disqualify himself from a case. That's in the Din Torah. Because, you know, one guy is nice and one guy isn't. He'll subconsciously look out for him. That's why the two litigants have to come into the room at the same time. They have all these procedures. But if you say, Nem, I trust your father. Now, obviously, your father's biased towards you. If he's a normal father, he likes his son more than he likes you. That's what he should do. But still, doesn't mean he can't see straight, and we'll accept that he'll overcome his subconscious biases and do what's right. So that's the Tiverjel HaChoshech Atzmo Min HaDin. It's not even, of course, the judges that's their job. That's a beautiful thing to be a judge. But it's the litigants should not try to do it. So they should always do what we call Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, or the Gemara calls, Pshara. I mentioned before that Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, the Talmud says Jerusalem was destroyed because the Jewish people, the Talmud says as follows. The Talmud says like this. Lo Charva Yerushalayim is a Gemara in Bava Metzia, Laman Amud Beit, I believe 30b in Bava Metzia. The Gemara says, Lo Charva Yerushalayim, the only reason Jerusalem was destroyed, Shadanu Dinayim of Dinei Torah, because the Jewish people did Dinei Torah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's exactly what the Gemara says. Wow. It says, what do you want them to do? Dinei de Garmizdar? I forget the exact word. Do you want to do what some pagan law? Well, what do you mean? That's the most wonderful thing in the world. They didn't say, no. They did Dinei Torah, but not Lifnei Mishurat HaDin. They were so insistent on judgment that destroyed the Jerusalem. Wow. People are always going to court and fighting, forget it. But because they didn't do Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, and we've mentioned before, it's a beautiful Gemara. Vahaviotim el Har Kochi, we say it on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur 100 times every day in the Slichus. Vahaviotim el Har Kochi v'simachtim v'vei tefilati, I will bring you to my holy mountain, v'simachtim, and I will rejoice with you v'vei tefilati, in my house of prayer. Ki beiti beit tefila yikarei l'chol amim, because this is the house, the temple is the house of prayer for Jews, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, Hindus. That's who is supposed to pray on Temple Mount, not like only, I'm not talking politically, but whatever, leave that aside. But the goal of the Temple Mount, that's when we know we'll have peace in the world. When Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Christians, whoever wants can pray on Temple. Ki beiti beit tefila yikarei l'chol amim. You say it on Yom Kippur 5 times or 10 times on Yom Kippur. You say it and then you say it again in Chazaret Hashat and say it every day in Slichas. You say it 50 times from Slichas or whatever. So we don't think about what we say. What can I tell you? Ki beiti beit tefila yikarei l'chol amim. But Beit Tefilati. So Beit Tefilati means in the temple. So in the Talmud has a very like a play on words, or I don't know if that's the correct term. Beit Tefilati, they're interpreting in a very literal sense. What it means in my house of prayer that we pray. Beit Tefilati means God, where God prays. God's talking. I will bring you to my mountain, to my place of prayer. Beit Tefilati, the place that I pray. So the Talmud says, we learn here, God prays. Right, we discussed this. What do you mean God prays? That's ridiculous. That doesn't make sense. So of course it means if God prays, we should pray. So you could say Kabbalistically, God needs us. Okay, that's a whole other question, a theological discussion, right? God needs the Jewish people. We don't have a king without servants, and etc. But the more standard and the thing is that whatever we know about God is for man. If God prays, so he's teaching us. We're created with Solomon. We have to pray. So what does God pray? It's such a beautiful Gemara. Brachot 7b, the top of the page. If you go to Brachot 7b, the Talmud says, it quotes this, and then it says, okay, that's cool, God prays. You know, I'm curious, what's God's prayer? So the Talmud says, God's prayer is that he should judge Lifnei Mishurat HaDin, that his attribute of mercy should overcome his attribute of anger, he should judge Lifnei Mishurat HaDin. So that, because without Mishurat HaDin, people are going to fight. Jerusalem will be destroyed. So that tells us how we're supposed to act. And Sarah Vergeth Rabbi Shmuel, don't fight. Don't go to court. We need judges. It's very important. a great judge, that's the highest level of Torah in practice. But the judge should guide people to compromise, and he should know how to apply the judge. Lefiyah makom, lefiyah zman. That's really a pshara. That's a really compromise. That's the role that I wanted to. By the way, the Gemara has it. I mean, one of the things that I actually don't miss about not davening in normal shuls is anim zmirot. I've always been, I guess maybe I'm too much influenced by Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik was opposed to saying anim zmirot except on Yom Kippur. And he was especially, I'm not critical, I understand, lefi hamakom or lefi hazman. I'm telling you what is the deen, maybe lefi hamakom or lefi hazman, it's great the way they do anim zmirot. Anim zmirot is like the highest praises of God. I don't know what it means. Anim zmirot, shimer, it's all these like, you know, God is this mystical vision, the beauty of God. It's so powerful that Rav Soloveitchik says it's inappropriate. I mean, he was the only one. It's inappropriate to say except on Yom Kippur. When everybody leaves shul, you know, very often in shul are people who stay behind on Yom Kippur night. They say all the stuff. The Shir HaYichud, they call it. The Song of the Unity. That's what Anim Zmirot. But it's much longer. On Yom Kippur, it's a much longer thing. It includes Anim Zmirot. So Soloveitchik said you say Anim Zmirot on Yom Kippur. You shouldn't say it every Shabbos. It's too holy to say every Shabbos. It cheapens it. And then to get an 8-year-old kid to go up and sing it, oh, that's like the, yeah. So, okay, Lefiyah Makom, I understand. I'm not passing judgment what you should. So I don't miss that they stop saying Anish Mirat. But Kesher Tefillin, Herav, Yanav, Timunar Hashem, L'negedei. Now, Kesher Tefillin. God has a Kesher Tefillin. God wears Tefillin. So the Gemara says, it's also it's very Kabbalistic and very, what's the word, anthropomorphism. You know, it's very anti-Rambam. The Rambam wouldn't like this at all. He would hate this, you know. So Kesher Tefillin, Hereva, and Ab, God wears Tefillin. So what's in God's Tefillin? This is already in the Gemara. The Gemara asks this question. So the Gemara says God's Tefillin is... hold on, let me, if I remember correctly, in our tefillin it says, you know, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. And in God's tefillin it says, Umi Ka'amcha Yisrael Goy Echad Baretz. I believe that's what the Gemara says. I have to look it up. Me, who is like you, my beloved? We praise God, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and God praises us. Umi Ka'amcha. And that's, I spoke last night about how the Torah is the relationship between God and the Jewish people, the love of God for the Jewish people. So it's expressed God wears tefillin as for God's praying. He's teaching us how to pray. It's all about the combination, the unity of Judaism and the Jewish people. So I just want to add a couple points here. I just want to say something cute so I don't forget it. I remember when I was in the Gris Kollel when I was going for smicha at YU. So, you know, many people learn Gris Kollel. That's, you know, people don't remember who Joseph Gruss is anymore. Any people know who Joseph Gruss was? You know, he was like the, I don't know what name you'd say. He was the biggest philanthropist in the 70s and the 80s. And he was the one, he gave millions of dollars so all the day schools in Israel could give teachers a pension plan. It's a beautiful idea because, you know, many of these schools don't have, you know, you retire or whatever, it's 60, 65. You know, you work in a big company, you get the pension. Many of these schools, they didn't have the money, they didn't have the capability, whatever, you know, they weren't run as whatever. It's not the, it was a different world. I don't have to tell you. So I think he put forth the money that the, through the federation, that all the day schools could pay. They did a lot of, it was a great bald stock.
Yeah, he had a seat in the New York Stock Exchange.
I had a seat in there. Yeah, he was a wealthy man. I mean, obviously. Yeah. Baruch Hashem, it's good to be wealthy. We're coming. We'll get into that next week. I thought I might get there today, but we'll get there next week.
He also gave money that teachers could have life insurance.
Life insurance, yeah, that's what I mean. Right, the whole idea. So he gave money. He wanted yeshiva. He wanted Rabbi Soloveitchik to move to Israel. And so he built a building there. It's called now the Gruss Kollel. Joseph, what was his wife's name? I forget already. Joseph, Joseph Gruss. And the idea was apparently, I'm sorry?
I think Caroline, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that sounds right. Joseph and Caroline Gruss, that's correct. So the idea, and apparently he had spoken to the Rav, and he spoke to the Rav, the idea was the Rav was going to go for 6 months to Israel. He would spend a few months in Israel and a few months here. Remember, his daughter lived in Israel, of course, Tova Lichtenstein, and that never happened. The Rav, as you may or may not know, went to Israel once in his life. In 19, everybody wonders, you know, after he died, why did the Rav never go to Israel? Rav Schechter said, I don't know if that's right. Rav Schechter said, he didn't go because a big waste of time. sort of not a nice thing almost. He said, no, if the Rav Soloveitchik went to Israel, he'd have to spend this time visiting this rabbi. It just sounds like it's a pain. I don't know. I don't know if that's the reason. Maybe like the Sri De'esh says, you know, Rav Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, this he writes in his letter, this he wrote himself, that one of the reasons he doesn't move to Israel, not to visit, he doesn't move, is because it has to choose. Israel is too polarized a country. And he would have to choose, does he want to be a religious Zionist, a Haredi, a university professor? He could have been all three. And I told you once, I believe, the Sri De'esh is the only person I know, that Rav Yaakov Yechiel Weinberg, the last rector of the Hildesheimer Seminary in Berlin before the war, and then he survived the war, and then he lived his life in Switzerland. He lived up his life in Montreux, Switzerland, like almost a meat bar, almost. Benny Gesundheit, who taught his classes, comes from Switzerland, his wife. The Sri De'esh was the son, like, I think, for his brother, her brother's bris. And they knew him very well. How many Jews, how many observant Jews lived in Switzerland? Anyway, so he, I believe, was offered jobs at Hebrew University, Jewish Theological Seminary, Yeshiva University, Yeshiva of Hebron. I mean, you don't have people like that, because he lived in so many worlds, and he didn't want to choose where he's going to live. Anyway, so but so the Rav Soloveitchik only visited Israel once in his life. So in 1935, to apply for the job as the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and Baruch Hashem, he didn't get the job. Otherwise, he went to whatever. But, and that's why in 1935, at 32 years old, he wanted the job. In 1959, after Rav Herzog died, and he was offered the job of chief rabbi, he turned it down because he knew what it meant to be a rabbi in Israel, a chief rabbi. It's your politician. He wasn't interested in that. So thank God he came in third place. He was a member of the Aguda in 1935, and the rabbis the people in Tel Aviv didn't want an Agudas rabbi. They wanted a Mizrahi rabbi. Then the rabbi became a Mizrahiite, the rabbi, and then the world turned Aguda. You know, he was always on the wrong side. Well, what can you do? What can you do? So anyways, Gross built this center for the Rav to come. And it's a long story, just to tell you a little point. So I remember when I was learning in the Gross Kollel, Rabbi Horowitz, they call him Whitey Horowitz, Alev HaShalom, was the founder of BMT, Beit Midrash LaTorah. The Gross Kollel was that they gave it to BMT, the Jewish agency, and then YU had the Kollel there. So I remember he told us, it had to do with on the Super Bowl. He was trying to convince people not to go to watch the Super Bowl. Then you couldn't watch it live, but people would leave like at 2 a.m, go to the Plaza Hotel, rent a room to watch the Super Bowl, whatever. So he told the whole story about judgment. Anyways, the punchline that relates to us is that why Ava, when you're a judge, you create enmity between that. In other words, and the way commentaries explain it is you're going to hate the judge. The guy who loses doesn't like the judge.
Yes.
So he says, you know, he says, the Shagasari, I think, is who he quoted from, said, a guy can have a cow, and he shechs the cow. And there's a shayla on the cow, if it's kosher. It goes to the rabbi. The rabbi looked at it. And, you know, rabbis try to be very lenient on these things, but the rabbi can't find the leniency. I'm sorry, rabbi, your $5,000 cow is not kosher. And you can sell it to a non-Jew for $100, and you just lost a ton of money. So what does the Jew do? He accepts it. He's a religious Jew. What can you do? What can you do? That's what it means to be a religious Jew. He doesn't get upset at the rabbi. I'm sorry? Okay, it's just, okay. He doesn't get upset at the rabbi, but that same Jew who has a court case with his neighbor and he loses $100 will curse the rabbi and swear and get him out and want to get back at him. Why? Because it's everything is relative. It's not that he lost, it's the other guy won. See, when it's me and my cow, I'm willing to be a religious Jew. It costs money keeping kosher. I'm willing to do that. But that I should lose money to that SOB, no way. That he should, that's unfortunately is so true about human nature. I think it was the Shagasari who said that comment, that Ava, why is there so much Ava in the court case? Well, there's going to be a little bit of money because you should win. God can win, so to speak. I won't have you win. But no, that's just a very sad comment, but it's a true comment. And I'll just end. I see it's getting late. I just want to, maybe I'll pick up on this a little bit next week, but I'll just introduce the introduction we've mentioned of the Igros Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein was the great posek, of course, in America, one of the great poskim of the world. Really, he understood things lefi hamakom ulefi hazman. He understood that, you know, so I'll just give one little example. You know, I mentioned this before, like on the tshuva, on the Israeli flag in shul, when they asked him, you know, people were very upset, you know, Haredi shul didn't want flags. And Rav Moshe didn't like the Israeli flag. I don't know what the word is. Rav Moshe wasn't a Zionist. I don't know, however you want to phrase it. Unlike Rav Soloveitchik, who said the Israeli flag has holiness to it because people have given their lives for it, whatever it might be. So Rav Moshe understood. He said, yeah, the Israeli flag, the people who founded Israel were all people who rebelled against Torah, you can, whatever. But that he has a very sharp critique on the Zionists, very sharp critique. But he says, you know what? We're not going to create a fight in shul over the flag. If the shul has a flag, don't make a fight. Let him keep it there. I mean, that's just a little indication. He understood, like, well, yes, an abstract halakha. Of course, you shouldn't have an American flag. He didn't think a flag belonged in a shul. But in the lefi hamakom or lefi hazman, you know, in America, I don't know, in America, do shuls all have American flags now? I don't remember. In Canada, we don't. But there used to be a thing that a lot of shuls, they would have a flag in shul. When I was growing up, I mean, shuls, like big shuls in the States, an American flag and Israeli flag. I don't know, whatever. So that's just one thing. Okay, I'll have to leave what he says about paskening halakha till next week. But, you know, this issue. But just basically, all we did is we discussed a little bit who Rav Yossi was and the students of Rabbi Akiva and the tour, the development of halakha and the difference between Ashkenazim and Sfardim in their approach, codification versus commentary, but really the tension, the very sharp tension between law and acting beyond the law and being a judge and creating where we have to create truth and peace, that struggle. And Dean, on the one hand, it's very important to be a judge. That's the greatest thing, come a partner with God. On the other hand, it's the dangers are very great. And that maybe that's just the way it has to be. And But there is fear, and people are people, and people make mistakes. And that's what the Mishnah, even the greatest of judges can make mistakes. And guess what? We'll get to next week. The halakha has a whole discussion. What happens if a judge makes a mistake? Who's responsible to pay for that mistake? Okay, we'll end here. Let me see if there are any questions. I want to thank you. Just like I mentioned at the beginning, for next week, I'll send out in the email, but the link will be slightly different. I'm going to update it to quote unquote our summer series. I sent an email last time. We have 4 new courses starting next week, beginning with Rabbi Liebtag on Sefer Dvarim on Monday, and Rachel Sharansky on Kings starting on Tuesday, and Simi Peters on Wednesday, and Sefer Yirmiyahu and Shuli Mishkin, the Tour of Israel on Thursday, plus our ongoing classes. So the link will be slightly different. You don't have to re-register for this class. You have to register for the other new classes, but anyways, okay, thank you very much. Okay, in front line of line, we said, thank you, truth is consistent. Yes, truth is consistent, but emet la'amito is not consistent. That's the difference. It's truth. Now, it's a higher truth. The higher truth is not to be consistent. That's the trick. That's lefi amakom and lefi hazman. It's a very powerful comment of the Drisha. It's quoted a lot. Okay, weren't the Aruch HaShulchan and the Alter Rebbe Ashkenazim? Yes. Okay, in modern times, like I said, today, every Ashkenazi rabbi begins at the Shulchan Aruch, right? You know, that's right. We don't live, we don't have the sharp divisions between Ashkenazim and Sephardim that we used to have. Unfortunate, and it's in many ways very unfortunate, the Sephardim have become Ashkenized, unfortunately. And in many ways, and the Sephardic, by the way, I didn't talk about that at all, but we know the Sephardic approach to halakha was always more moderate. I don't know what the words to use. In other words, in general, poskim were always lenient. Even the great people you think, even the Chatam Sofer people you think of, but in halakha, but I'm talking more these, you know, one of the reasons there's almost no such thing as a conservative or reform Sephardic, you know, shul or temple, whatever you want to call it, because they didn't throw you out. As Rabbi Rakepet used to say, in Hungary, if you put on brown shoes, they sat shiva for you. You know, like, you know, they any deviation. My uncle told me, who I quoted last night in my share, my uncle spoke at our wedding, quoted that when you put on a tie, he remembers you put on a tie, oh my gosh, that's your Paris, you're assimilated, you're modern. That's to Today, they'll throw you out of a yeshiva if you don't wear a tie, right? But at the time, it's very modern. So the Ashkenazim always had rifts and schisms. So, you know, people left. They started their own shul, the Reform Temple. They wanted to make changes. The Sephardic shuls were always much more warm. I mean, there's more to discuss here, but there is a different approach for the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim. And it's nice that we intermarried. It's beautiful, and we come to Israel, and we're one, and there's no such thing in halakha as Sephardim and Ashkenazim. There is a, but there, the, you know, the approach is, we don't want to take away from the way it used to be. Yes, so the Aruch HaShulchan, we can talk about him another time, sort of an update of the Shulchan Aruch, written in the 19th century by Rav Yaakov Yechiel Michal Epstein, the father of the Torah Tmima. The Torah Tmima is more famous, that commentary on the Torah, I think, but his father. Of course, the Alter Rebbe, so I'm very unfamiliar with the Alter Rebbe, the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. I must confess my ignorance. I don't think I've ever opened the Shulchan, maybe once in my life I opened up the Shulchan Aruch HaRav. That, of course, was written by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe in the 1700s, who was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, unlike most early Hasidic Rebbes, who many were, I don't know if they were ignorant. Some probably were ignorant, and many were, I don't know, but some, but they weren't great scholars, nor that important. A spiritual leader, the most important thing a spiritual leader is not how much Torah he knows. So we discussed that. So it's okay. But the Balatanya, as they say, used to be, he was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. And because the Hasidim were a little bit different, he had to write his own Shulchan. He had to write his own Shulchan Aruch. But Zev, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with it.
You should read it because he gives the sources of all his decisions.
Yeah, my understanding is that the Shulchan Aruch HaRav is a way to, it's basically like on the Rambam, it's the Taryak Mitzvot. He understands Halakha is the implementation of the Taryak Mitzvot. And I think that's, but I'm not familiar with Shulchan Aruch HaRav. I really can't comment on it. I just, you know, scholars say the impetus for making codes was external. That could very well be. Not internal. Islamic world had codes for sure. I mean, often trends in halakha, so much wearing a tie. Of course, a tie is a Koyish custom. Just became co-opted by us. Of course, that's like a silly external influence. Yes. The most part, well, Ashkenaz relationships were more tense. That's the same reason why Sephardim were more cultured and they studied philosophy because they, right, Ashkenazim, because the Christian world in the Dark Ages, Jews wanted nothing to do with Christians, anti-Semitism, the Golden Age. If you live when the Goyim are nice to you, why are we all Americanized? Even me who live in Canada, I'll use that term, you know, North Americanized, right? We're all totally American. The way we think and that influences halakha, the way we talk, the way we, everything, our whole culture is America's because we love America because America has been so good to you. That's the fear now, anti-Semitism. We've never had this before in our history of America, what's going on now. You know, I saw Abraham Foxman, the former head of the ADL, was interviewed in the Times of Israel this week. So he made a comment. It's very fascinating. He said, since Leo Frank, in 1913, no Jew until Pittsburgh, no Jew in America was killed because he was a Jew for over 100 years. I was like, wow, that's amazing. Is that true? Does anyone have any Jew who was killed in America? We never had any place where Jews lived for 100 years and nobody was killed because they were Jewish. So whatever. But when you live in a country where you like the values of the country, we pick up and we adapt and we change. And yes, we take the norms of America. So the Sephardim did that much, much more. And the Ashkenazi much, much less because of the cultures they were living in, 100%. Okay, more modern Jewish stuff flags. Yeah, that's not surprising. Young Israel, okay, good. I guess that means Young Israel is a modern shul. Okay. Todah Rabah. Okay. Thank you very much. And okay. Thank you very much, everybody. We look forward to seeing you Sunday morning, 11:15. Rabbi Liebtag, Sefer Dvarim, the most difficult book to understand, something like that. It's going to be a 15-week series. One of the early talks I heard on Menachem Liebtag in Toronto, he gave at a private home, was sort of an overview of Sefer Dvarim, the problems in Sefer Dvarim. So I invite everybody into all the classes, and please God, we'll see you next week. But like I say, just follow the emails in terms of any switches in the how to log on. And nothing major, and everybody have a Shabbat Shalom. Be well. If you have any questions, sure, I'm happy. I think Mr. Zucker, I think you want to ask something. Right. I want to wish everybody well. A Shabbat Shalom. Be
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
so the summer continuation of these is a password change or is it still spring?
I'm sorry?
For the summer continuation of like the series.
The series, I'll continue, yeah.
Yes, it's the same password.
Just the link and the password, if you go to Zoom, just to keep it the same for everybody, it'll just be a slightly different link. That's all. You'll get it in the email.
But the password's the same.
Spring. No, the password will move from spring to summer.
Okay.
Right now, the password is spring. So right. I'm letting you know, but I'm also going to send it out by email. So you get the reminder emails, right? About this.
Yeah,
so it'll be in the reminder. But if you forget, just type in summer instead of spring, and you'll be able to get it.
Thank you.
That's okay. All right. Be well. Thank you.
Be well.
Have a great Shabbos.
Rosenbaum and Crown Heights. Yeah. That's... interesting, right? I remember that was in the 90s, I believe, right? It was shot on the Crown Heights riots. I forgot about that. Okay. Yeah. Okay, everybody should be well. And, we should hear good news. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you. Bye.